It's Wednesday, June 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a new report suggests Asia has the most people in slavery conditions.
It illustrates yet one more time that he's continuing to fail.
North Korea attempts another missile launch. Also ahead, overcoming physical disabilities to reach ultimate heights. And new movies on the way. One critic isn't impressed. It's all on today's International Edition. According to the 2016 Global Slavery Index, released on Tuesday, nearly 46 million people are trapped in conditions that amount to slavery, with two-thirds of them found in the Asia-Pacific region. The report is the work of the Australia-based Walk Free Foundation, the creation of Australian mining magnate and philanthropist Andrew Forrest. The index, conducted biannually, is the result of nationally representative random sample surveys in 25 countries involving face-to-face interviews in key local languages. The sampling represents about 44% of the global population, and Fiona David, Executive Director for Research at the Foundation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that slavery is simply defined as a situation in which people cannot refuse and cannot leave.
It's highly exploitative. So they might be in forced labor, they might be in some form of stone quarry work, forced prostitution, for example, and another person is stopping them from leaving that situation.
How did you come by this number?
We have done surveys this year with our partner organization, Gallup, in more than 25 countries, having interviewed face-to-face, so that's a, you know, sitting across the table from each other, having a conversation, face-to-face interviews with more than 42,000 people in more than 53 languages.
Are you convinced of the accuracy of this number?
Every estimate that we do with the Global Slavery Index, and this is the third estimate that we have produced, gets sharper and sharper. So yes, I'm absolutely convinced that this is the best estimate we have so far. Having said that, estimating a problem as hidden and as criminal as modern-day slavery is not something to be undertaken lightly. It's not an easy thing to do.
Most of them are in the Asia-Pacific region. Why is that?
What we see is surprisingly large numbers of people in some form of forced labour or even forced marriage in countries including Bangladesh. So the surveys in Bangladesh showed an estimated 1.5 million people being held in some form of forced labour. And of course, Bangladesh is a large producer of ready-made clothing for consumers around the world. So this really has implications for everyday people in terms of what clothing they buy and sell. The same can be said for Cambodia. Again, some 250,000 people in that country, a much smaller country, being held in some form of forced labour. Some of that is of domestic workers. Of course, they are a very vulnerable group, working in private homes, out of the reach of labour law, out of the public gaze, out of public sight. But the Cambodia estimate also includes a significant proportion of people in manufacturing. From my own country, Australia, to, for example, India, which is the country we estimate has the absolute largest number of people living in some form of slavery. But the good news is many governments are working very hard on this issue, including the government of India. Yesterday announced a new series of legislative reforms. It recently has started responding to a Supreme Court decision which has called for a whole series of new actions on this. Yes, it has a big problem, but importantly, the government is taking steps to do something about it.
The index says more than half, or 58% of those living in slave conditions are in five countries: India, China, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Uzbekistan. It says the 21 countries with the highest proportion of their populations in modern slavery are in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. Fiona David said the purpose of the index is to let people know the extent of the problem so that sensible strategies can be devised to manage it. We turn now to our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 to bring us what's buzzing online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
A well-known scientist has weighed in on the GOP's presumptive nominee, Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Imagine this. Now, we don't get to talk about Stephen Hawking all that much, but why don't you tell us about it?
Well, he is actually, without a doubt, one of the most respected theoretical physicists of our time, and he did an interview with UK's ITV and answered many questions from Brexit to international politics. Of course, US politics falls under that. When the host asked him for possible reasons behind Trump's popularity, he answered, he can't think of any.
Well, he didn't mention the term black hole and Trump in the same sentence, did he?
He didn't.
What did he say exactly?
Well, he elaborated Trump is a demagogue who seems to appeal to the lowest common denominator, but didn't really specify what that actually means. CNN, MSNBC, and The Washington Post are all talking about it on various social media platforms. And as you know, Jim, these media outlets are not rooting for Trump. They're rooting for the other candidate. Mm-hmm. I'm going to zip it right here.
Okay.
So let's check out some of the comments to their post on Facebook. One of the most liked comments to the MSNBC post reads, "Hawking, maybe this generation's most brilliant mind, but you do not need to be particularly brilliant to determine Trump's lowest common denominator strategy." As for CNN, under its post, the most popular comment actually defends Trump. More than 1,000 people liked this comment. "This just goes to show that many so-called geniuses rarely display intelligence outside their respective fields of expertise."
And Stephen Hawking is probably one of the most brilliant people as far as astrophysics goes. How significant is his comment?
He has a lot of influence and opinionated on important topics such as climate change and the Middle East conflict. And because it communicates using a computerized voice that pronounces words, is spelled out a letter at a time, we can assume his opinions are carefully considered. I mean, he has to go through all of this trouble to make his opinions counted. You can also connect with him on Twitter. His handle is @StephenHawking8. So that's his full name plus number 8. He joined Twitter on August 2010 and sent out 10 tweets so far, all of them in that year. And even though he tweeted out only 10 times, he has almost 44,000 followers. I'm very envious of that.
Wow.
Jim?
Well, thanks so much for that wrap-up, G. You may tweet your questions and comments, perhaps more than 10, to @VOA_IE. And you may also tag myself and G on those tweets if you like. We're @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Among the top stories that we're following right now in Asia, Pakistani Prime Minister undergoes open-heart surgery in London. China's Alibaba faces U.S. investigations. Pakistan hands over body of slain Afghan Taliban chief to relatives. Surging growth helps India retain fastest-growing economy tag. Dramatic rise in the number of Afghans displaced by conflict. You may find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at our voanews.com website. And they're also available, if you have a smartphone, on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. South Korea's military on Tuesday said North Korea appears to have failed in its latest ballistic missile test from a East Coast location near the city of Wonsan. The South Korean Yonhap News Agency saying it appeared to have been an attempt to launch a medium-range Musudan missile. If true, as Korea analyst Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation notes, this is believed to be the fourth failure in an effort to successfully launch that missile.
So they've had three previous failures of the Musudan missile. This had not been a missile that they had tested, at least from North Korea, previous to this year, and they tried testing it in the ramp-up to the Seventh Party Congress in order to make a political statement, but they didn't make the statement they wanted to because they got failures. This would suggest that North Korea thought that they had figured out whatever the problems were, because Kim Jong-un would not want to have more failures. He's going to want to have a success. He was going to want to try to erase for his leadership, who would understand a little bit at least of what was going on, that he wasn't continuing to fail. The fact that it failed again is not good news for Kim Jong-un. It illustrates yet one more time that he's continuing to fail.
The test comes amid heightened Korean tensions in the wake of the North's January nuclear test, its fourth since 2006, along with recent satellite and various missile launches, all in violation of UN Security Council resolutions. If indeed this was a Musudan missile launch, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's prestige is very much on the line, and Bruce Bennett describes the missile.
Musudan missile is believed to have between about a 3,000 and 4,000 kilometer range, about enough range to reach Guam, so it can also cover any part of Japan, it can cover a good part of China, and a lot of Asian Russia. So it is a threat broadly throughout the region. It is derived from the Soviet SSN-6 missile, which they used to have on their submarines. So it was originally a submarine launch ballistic missile, and in that configuration, it always carried a nuclear warhead. So there is a serious concern that this missile would be designed to carry nuclear warheads, even by North Korea. North Korea lengthened the missile to get it to go for a longer range, and that may be a part of the problem. They may not have gotten a good design in trying to lengthen it. But at this stage, it's a little early to tell what the problems are.
Bruce Bennett says that he doubts North Korea will attempt another nuclear test until the problems with the missile are worked out. And he says the fact that further nuclear testing has not been conducted suggests to him that North Korean scientists, whose lives may be in jeopardy should there be another failure, want to make sure that they get it right.
There had been a lot of discussion that North Korea was going to do a test right before the Party Congress, but I think we have to look at it practically. The test back in January was actually a failure. It was intended to demonstrate H-bomb capability, which means a degree of fusion, and it didn't. It really showed basically a fission explosion. It was about a fifth the size that apparently North Korea had intended it to be. And so they had some big issues to work out, just like they do with this missile potentially.
Well, meanwhile, Japanese media reports that senior North Korean official Ri Su-young, vice chairman of the ruling Workers' Party, is in Beijing to brief Chinese officials on a rare four-day meeting that further consolidated Kim Jong-un's power, and that was held in early May. Well, it's that time of the year. New movies are coming out to a theater near you. Are they any good? We'll find out, but first, this year's climbing season at the world's tallest mountain, Mount Everest, is being marked by a number of positive achievements and records after 2 years of major tragedies. It's the topic of our latest hashtag VOA TV show, and its host Michael Lippin is with me right here in the studio. Michael, who did you speak with and about the good news coming out of Mount Everest for change?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me here. Well, first up on this week's show, my co-host Andrew Polchemski spoke to two U.S.-based climbers, Corey Richards and Adrian Ballinger, who trekked up Mount Everest earlier this month without the use of supplemental oxygen. Only Richards made it to the top, but both of them scored a first by documenting their arduous journey on several social media apps, including Snapchat. Andrew asked Ballinger whether these apps helped them to show the world what the climbing process is like.
I certainly think so. I think, you know, one of the things we really wanted to show through this story and sort of differently than Instagram is this idea of how in-depth climbing a big mountain like this is. It's not just the summit push, which is what people think of those last 4 or 5 days, but instead it's this 2+ month process where there's so much work to be done. There's a lot of boredom. There's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of, like, mini failures and successes along the way, long before we actually spend, you know, Corey spent his 3 minutes on the summit. But there's so much more than that before that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly the point. Using these apps is one of those things that basically It enables us to share a much broader term story over a much broader term period of time and give people a more holistic view of what it actually takes. It can be sort of exhausting and almost boring to people at times, but I think that's also the beauty of it. let people be bored because we're bored. And if we're going to use those storytelling tools that we have these days, let people be excited when we're excited. Bring them through the whole emotional process, and you start to get a much more well-rounded view of how these things actually work.
And that was Corey Richards there. Also on the show, I spoke via Skype to Todd Burnett, who co-founded the U.S. nonprofit group U.S. Expeditions and Explorations, or USX. Burnett mobilized the first ever team of active and retired U.S. military personnel to scale Mount Everest with the goal of raising awareness about post-traumatic stress disorder, a condition that many U.S. veterans suffer from. Well, the retired officer on that three-person team, Chad Jukes, is actually a disabled vet whose leg was amputated due to wounds from the Iraq War. I asked Burnett how he recruited Jukes for the mission.
You know, Chad's probably the most senior climber, and he saw that they were going to climb, and, you know, he reached out. They reached out back to them, and it became something that he had a cause that he wanted to raise awareness. You know, Chad is a single amputee from an explosive improvised device, and, you know, suffers from post-traumatic stress. The other thing that's kind of like Chad's up there climbing, you know, one of his army buddies committed suicide while he was on the climb to Everest. So, you know, he had to kind of reevaluate and get situated because that's a dramatic, you know, very traumatic experience again that he's going through. But his resilience and his, you know, his ability to, you know, cope with that and want to continue the mission speaks volume about Chad, the person that he is, and what he wants to do to keep this momentum.
Well, we also had two other guests on the show, both record-breaking climbers in their own right. One was Lakpa Sherpa, a Nepalese immigrant to the U.S. who has reached Everest 7 times more than any other woman. We can check out what they said and more from the other guests by watching the full show on voanews.com/#VOA and on my Facebook profile, Michael.Lippin. Jim?
I'm always in awe of people who make it to the summit of Mount Everest. Thank you so much for bringing us that story, Michael Lippin.
Sure.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, it's time here in the United States for the summer movie season to get underway, and Jeffrey K. Howard of VegasFilmCritic.com joins VOA's Lori London to talk about a couple of them.
Well, the big elephant in the room is, of course, the long-awaited X-Men sequel, X-Men Apocalypse, and this is with the younger cast. So this is actually a sequel to of the previous X-Men where they're younger, you know, so it's kind of hard to keep them all tracked because there's like 10 or 11 of them keep bouncing around. So this one has the origins of Apocalypse, who is considered the first mutant, and he's back in ancient Egyptian times. And of course, he's rebelled against, and he's trapped for thousands of years. Well, he wakes up, sees the modern world, and goes, well, wait a minute, you know, I want to rule this, but he starts destroying everything, but he needs some of the X-Men's help because he can absorb their powers. So it's almost like Captain America Civil War we had earlier this summer where the Avengers were split in half. Well, now we have some of the X-Men becoming bad guys and we have some of the X-Men being the good guys. So we have this 2.5-hour 3D extravaganza of the X-Men fighting the ultimate mutant Apocalypse played by Oscar Isaac. Now, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. He is a weak villain. He is absolutely corny and weak, and overall the movie just doesn't have the spark, and it doesn't have... It's confusing, and it's just, I think the X-Men is starting to play out like the Spider-Man movies have, where it's just not becoming, it's not intriguing audiences, and it's getting more and more complicated, but it's for more comic book fans. I have comic book fans coming up to me saying, well, wait a minute, this character was this and this, and they start going through all these incredible details. I go, look, it needs to be a movie, not a 20 comic book series, you know? So I didn't like it. I was disappointed in it, but it did like $80 million so far this opening weekend. So fans are going crazy over it. But overall, I thought the average moviegoer is going to be bored with it.
What about this other one, Alice Through the Looking Glass? Is this sort of an adult version of Alice in Wonderland?
Well, no, this is technically the sequel to the Tim Burton movie from 2012, but it's from Walt Disney Pictures, and it stars Johnny Depp again as the Mad Hatter. And this time Alice is grown up, and she goes back to Wonderland by total accident through the looking glass, where she finds the Mad Hatter is depressed because he misses his family. We find out that the family of the Mad Hatter was killed by the Jabberwocky, the dragon-like creature. So she must find the timekeeper, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, and travel through time. I know, can you believe that? A time travel movie. Yeah, it's bad enough when we see it through Star Trek trying to keep track of everything. Can you imagine bouncing around the timeline in Wonderland? And that's exactly what happens, because it gets so confusing and so crazy that there's no fun in this movie. Johnny Depp is just borderline psychotic in this movie. And Sacha Baron Cohen is the only thing that's kind of cool with the timekeeper, but it's already bombed. I mean, it has landed with a thud at the box office, and rightly so. It is unimaginative, and poor Disney, and Johnny Depp is in the headlines with all his troubles. So this is a really, really disappointment for a lot of his fans.
Well, Jeff does like a few of the films. You can check out all of his reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, VOAnews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, on Twitter at VOA_IE. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Dan Crafton, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Blocking ISIL's ability to raise funds, pay its fighters, and finance its operations is one of the keys to degrading and eventually destroying this terrorist organization. ISIL, also known as Daesh, finances itself through extortion, public goods taxes, corporate force profit sharing, and by selling oil, stolen antiquities, and even slaves. That is why the United States Department of State designates foreign terrorist organizations, or specially designated global terrorists, under Executive Order 13224. By designating such groups, the United States freezes what funds they may have within the reach of U.S. authorities. Once terrorist groups are designated, they are effectively locked out of the international banking system, thus losing their ability to transfer money to vendors and to receive money from donors. As well as U.S. businesses, manufacturers, and individuals are prohibited from dealing or trading with them. 18 months ago, ISIL leader and State Department specially designated global terrorist Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi welcomed the three oaths of allegiance from fighters in Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and Libya, thereby creating ISIL branches in those countries. In late May, the United States Department of State designated ISIL's branches in Libya, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia as specially designated global terrorists. It also designated the Libya branch as a foreign terrorist organization. Since proclaiming their allegiance to ISIL, all three branches have carried out a number of deadly attacks. Among other acts of terrorism, ISIL Yemen claimed responsibility for a pair of March 2015 suicide bombings targeting two separate mosques in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. As a result, over 120 people died and more than 300 were wounded. ISIL Saudi Arabia has carried out numerous attacks against Shia mosques in both Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, killing over 50 people. ISIL Libya kidnapped and murdered a group of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians. They have also staged numerous attacks targeting both government and civilians, which resulted in dozens of deaths. Through the use of terrorism designations, the United States exposes and isolates groups and individuals engaged in terrorism. A designation not only imposes serious sanctions on violent organizations, it allows all segments of the U.S. government, in concert with our international partners, to take action to disrupt the terrorists' nefarious activities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.